You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 14th of May 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson, and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, the violent clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinian militants escalates again, but the response from Washington is muted. We'll ask if President Biden has put the Middle East on the back burner, only to find himself ill-prepared for trouble. Also coming up, New Zealand tells the world it's opening up for business, but is the world still interested? And then as Chile heads to the polls, we'll look ahead to this weekend's elections to choose the people who'll write the country's next constitution. Plus,
it just means we've got to get to as many people as possible with vaccines as promptly as possible so that we can stamp the virus down before it comes back with a variant.
The final instalment of our special series on vaccine hesitancy around the world. All that plus a recap of the week's news highlights and a look at the newspapers too. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Fully vaccinated Americans have been told they can stop wearing a face mask in most indoor and outdoor settings. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been cleared of wrongdoing in the We charity scandal. And the centre of the city of Paris could be free of traffic by as early as next year, as the council wants to ban through traffic in four central districts. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, Hamas militants have launched dozens of rockets at Israel in response to a deadly airstrike on a tower block in Gaza, which killed senior commanders and a number of civilians. The escalation has triggered fierce street clashes in Israel between Jews and Israeli Arabs. Alison Kaplan-Sommer is a journalist for the Haaretz newspaper in Tel Aviv, and she sent us this dispatch.
The escalating conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza raged on overnight Thursday and through Friday morning. So far, it's cost 7 Israeli lives and killed more than 100 Palestinians. Overnight, the Israeli army said that 160 jets carried out airstrikes in northern Gaza, attacking some 150 targets, which they said were built on top of Hamas underground infrastructure. Medical sources in the Gaza Strip said that among the casualties were a father and 3 of his daughters. Meanwhile, the rocket attacks from Gaza continued nonstop overnight, with sirens going on across southern Israel, sending millions of Israelis into shelters. For the first time in 3 nights, there were no significant attacks on central Israel in the more northern area. One barrage of rocket fire launched from Gaza landed 5 rockets in the southern city of Ashkelon. One hit a residential building and seriously injured a 60-year-old and a 90-year-old man. Internal violence across the country continued Thursday evening. Right-wing Jewish activists vandalized and lit Arab businesses on fire in the city of Lod in retaliation for what they said was Arab violence against Jews the previous evenings. Jews were also attacked violently by Arabs in some cities across the country. On the political front, the anti-Netanyahu political bloc fell apart in the wake of the tensions. Right-wing leader Naftali Bennett announced that he would not be joining other parties to offer an alternative coalition to the current Netanyahu government following last month's elections. Meanwhile, the United Nations said it would proceed with Security Council meetings to publicly discuss the worsening violence between Israel and the Palestinians over the U.S. objections, over the objections of the United States. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a statement saying that Hamas will pay, quote, a very heavy price for their actions. Netanyahu said, "We will continue to do what we're doing with great intensity. The last word has not yet been uttered, and the operation would continue as long as necessary." He also addressed the internal violence in the country, calling on the citizens of Israel not to take the law into their own hands.
That was Alison Kaplan-Sommer from Haaretz newspaper there, bringing us an update as to what's happened in the last 12 or so hours. So what can America do when it comes to the current violence in the Middle East? Does it have any role to play anymore? Well, to discuss this, I'm joined by Yossi Meckelberg, a senior consulting research fellow at the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Good morning, Yossi.
Good morning, Emma.
We have just seen another night where it's gone from, one could arguably say, tension and clashes on Monday to what looks like full-on war now. This is moving faster than anyone could ever imagine.
It is. And in a way, we experienced this in the past, in other ways, as we could have from the dispatched. It's worse than, because it's escalated from Jerusalem to inside Israel to war with Gaza, clashes in the West Bank. There were even reports on some rockets coming from Lebanon, sporadic ones. So it's almost 3-4 fronts at the same time for Israel. And that's why it requires de-escalation with a sense of urgency. In this sense, the United States should play a very significant role. What we see right now is the Biden administration create the space for Israel to retaliate, almost massive retaliation, even few more days to what they see as restoring their deterrence vis-a-vis the Hamas, while the Hamas sees themselves as basically achieve their strategic objectives in this round of violence.
You said that, you know, the United States should be taking a more central role. I mean, ordinarily, planes would be shuttling backwards and forwards from Washington to try to achieve some sort of peace. Is that happening now? And if not, why not?
Happened behind the scenes, but what we see is the Security Council was blocked by the United States for now from passing a resolution. And it reconvenes on Sunday. And hopefully there will be a resolution coming from the Security Council. So what's happening is creating this space for the Israeli military to pound the Hamas, basically, restore deterrence. Because Hamas, in a way, initiated this round of violence, comes seen as the defender of Jerusalem, making this new equation between Gaza, Jerusalem, and the Israeli Palestinians, the Arab Israeli citizens. And that's exactly the Israel's nightmare. So in a way, probably in the discussion between Washington and the Israeli government, they ask for a few more days, hit the Hamas as hard as possible, and then declare a ceasefire.
Tell us a little bit more about the speed with which it's happening and the effect on the way that the diplomatic efforts can be played out. We mentioned a moment ago that this is happening so quickly, but many have argued that Joe Biden has been watching this for years and years as Secretary of State and now as President, as Vice President and now as President. But it very much looks as if Washington's been caught very much unprepared here.
I think not only Washington, it's also Israel was caught by surprise, by the ferocity of what happened in so many fronts. But I think Biden administration entered into the White House thinking that their priority, one, deal with the aftermath of the pandemic, or say stop the pandemic from spreading. We tend to forget a few months after President Trump left office, but the chaos that he left behind him, and it was too for Biden, President Biden, to pick up the pieces. So now with the vaccination, then with the economic, so investing $4 trillion. Then in foreign affairs terms, the priorities were China and Russia. And I think also in this program said in the past that for Biden, the Middle East is not high priority, but he probably should consult his former boss in the White House. They said towards the end of his time in the White House that you enter the White House thinking, I can ignore the Middle East because success there is very rare, but you at the end of the day sucked into this. And I think what happens right now, early in his presidency, is sucked into another Middle East conflict.
And it has happened in the same way that it happened to Bill Clinton, to George Bush, to Barack Obama. They all failed. Donald Trump, his deal was arguably never going to work because of it was so favouring the Israelis that the Palestinians would never say yes to it. I mean, Joe Biden has a point, doesn't he? It is not a situation that you can ever get out of simply. Is it just the speed with which things have happened or the fact that it just is not something that he'd even considered?
I would argue... That's the foreign affairs generally, and it's never simple. Is it simple? The relations with Russia are simple, with China are simple. It's not simple. It's a matter of priority. and readiness to put your political power behind a policy. And I think for the United States, one of the lessons, if it's not ready to put its full political power, its influence on all the sides, in order once and for all to bring an end to this conflict, it will come and haunt time and again. And eventually it will be brought back into the conflict with implication for U.S. position in the Middle East and beyond. And I think it will take a courageous administration to do something about it, and also to deal with the domestic implication in the United States for taking such a stand.
What can the U.S. do in terms of reaching out to neighbors in this situation? We understand that Washington has already contacted Egypt, Qatar, Jordan, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, and there have been dozens of urgent calls. Is that the right strategy insofar as reach out to the neighbours as well as to those involved directly in the conflict?
I believe so. I think we've past experience saw that it was Egypt, with the support of Saudi Arabia, that managed to broker ceasefire. And they have the influence. With Qatar influence on Hamas by sponsoring them, I think they can have impact. And I think that the United States can build a coalition of peace. But most importantly, not to stop at a ceasefire. The problem is there is ceasefire, there is calm, and then everyone goes and say, we solve it. No, they need to go back when there is ceasefire to use the momentum of negotiation and agreement to go further into deal with the underlying issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Finally, we're looking at a think tank which in the last couple of days has issued a policy paper. It's the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the US Middle East Project. And they have come up with the idea that a way of helping Washington solve the Israeli-Palestinian issue is to come up with the idea of equality, to centre equal rights for both peoples. Is that a big enough break and a big enough idea that actually it could make some headway?
This is an idea that I hear on both sides, mainly from the Palestinians, for years now. Forget about talking about the nuts of bolts of where is the capital and where is the borders going to be drawn. First and foremost, let's talk about our rights as human beings. And if you talk about the rights, whether it's self-determination or human rights, civil rights, this will actually, the solution will become more obvious. So I think there is something in that, that's talking about rights, especially when we see more and more reports talking about an apartheid state. I think we need to go into basics in this sense about what people deserve as human beings and have a right-based discussion. It's not a bad place to start.
Yossi Meckelberg, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist.
What kind of city do you want to live in? Every week on The Urbanist, we delve into the biggest questions about urban living and meet the people championing change in our cities. From Starkitects to Designosauruses, protected views to landfills, river walks and sidewalks, wayfinding and cycle highways, the city is alive and kicking. So how can we make them better places to live in?
The other great city creation, of course, is sex. Young people go to cities to have a good time and to enjoy themselves and to meet their life partners and maybe a few other people on the way.
Join me, Andrew Tuck, every Thursday at 2000 hours London time for a brand new episode. Or subscribe to the podcast and listen as you go. The Urbanist, the show that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
(laughs) 7:14 here in London, you're with The Globalist. It's more than a year and a half since Chileans took to the streets to demand a change to their constitution. Dozens of people died in the protest. In what's being viewed by many as the next step in that fight, this weekend they go to the polls in the country's municipal regional elections. They're also choosing 155 people who'll write Chile's next constitution. Well, to find out more, I'm joined by Maria Luisa Puig, who's a Latin America analyst at the Eurasia Group. Good morning, Maria Luisa.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
It's good to have you. Could you just recap the protests that have led us to this moment, please?
Yes. So, well, massive demonstrations erupted in 2019. They were triggered by a hike in metro fares. but actually they exposed widespread discontent, which had to do with a range of issues, including the new constitution, but not limited to the new constitution. It had to do also with this demand that we have seen in Chile and in Latin America as a whole for more and better public spending.
And this was violent, and dozens of people died in all this. I mean, how much did it shake Chile?
Well, I think that it was a breaking point. I think that Chile can be seen as a country before the protests and after the protests. So, to begin with, it forced a significant increase in social spending, and most specifically and most importantly, it forced the government and the political class as a whole to reach agreement on embarking in a process to rewrite the constitution. So the new constitution is going to be written after the elections this weekend. The constituent convention is going to take up to a year to write a new constitution. After that, it is going to be submitted for a referendum. But I would say that this process of the new constitution, in a way, started with the demonstration. So they were in a way that trigger as well for the new constitution to be drafted.
Given what the people were protesting about, do we know what shape the constitution is likely to take, where the priorities lie and where it will be a departure from the previous one?
Yeah, I would say that in general, the shape of the constitution has been the main question throughout all of these several months over the years since the demonstrations erupted. Nobody really knows the final form because they are going to start from scratch. I would say that in general, you could imagine a constitution that goes in the direction of expanding the role of the state and its safety net, that meaning more in education, in pensions, in health. That also means that Chile will probably face higher fiscal pressure over the coming years. And I would say that very much depends, but it's not limited or that is regardless of the results this weekend. And the reason for that is that there is overall agreement or that the political class as a whole, including the center-right, the center-left, and the more radical groups, agree in a way that this constitution should go in this direction, because that was precisely one of the main demands that was evident from the demonstrations in 2019.
With a new constitution replacing the one from 1980, which is enacted at the height of the period of the dictator Augusto Pinochet, how could Chile look in 5 or 10 years' time in terms of the society, the economy, and just the general character of the country?
Yeah, no, and this is key as well, right? Because the demand for the new constitution had to do with the contents of the new constitution, with what people expect for the constitution to have. But it also has very much to do with when the previous constitution, the existing constitution, was approved, which was during the Pinochet dictatorship. So while there are many people that demand a new constitution, this doesn't necessarily has to do only with the contents, but also because of when the current one was approved. So what I would expect is a new constitution, a constitution that is submitted for referendum in 2022, a constitution that goes in the direction of providing more and better welfare, social services. So this will probably translate into more presence and a more generous state in terms of education, health, pensions as well. This is a process that is going to take time. You know, the effects of the new constitution are not felt by citizens from one day to the other. So there is also the issue of meeting very high expectations around this process, which could take some years, and also how to pay the bill, right? Because while there is overall agreement on the need to go in this direction, at some point there will be the need to engage in a discussion into how to hike taxes, how to increase revenue in order to fund this greater social spending. I think that this is for sure going to be the path that Chile follows, one of being more generous in terms of social services, but at the same time probably greater spending on that front.
Maria Luisa Puig, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's Globalist, Andrew Muller is here with a pithy recap of some of the best bits of the last 7 days' news.
We've learned that should Johnson be unable to raise this sum soonish, the gaiety of the nation may be enlarged in coming weeks by hired goons kicking in the UK's most famous door and seizing the Downing Street trouser press.
I'm not sure Boris Johnson has a trouser press. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, New Zealand earned a reputation last year for dealing sharply and effectively with the coronavirus, but that came at a price. The country effectively shut itself off from the rest of the world. And as a result, as the country emerges from the pandemic, an effort is being made to tell the world we're open again. Well, Lloyd Burr is Europe correspondent for News Hub and joins me here in the studio. Welcome back, Lloyd. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
It is good to be here as the world is opening up again. But let's go back to this time last year when the New Zealand government basically shut everything down. Just recap the strategy during the pandemic.
Well, yeah, they pretty much went into lockdown the same time as the UK did at the beginning of last year, which was weird because there weren't that many cases in New Zealand. Remember, it was sort of going rampant in the UK, but New Zealand decided to go hard and fast. They shut the borders to everyone other than citizens, and they launched an initiative hotel quarantine system pretty much straight away because there was no one in the hotels. And so they, it's called a government quarantine. It's mandatory. You arrive on a plane and you just get chucked into a hotel and you're there for 2 weeks and surrounded by people in suits and getting swabs and stuff. So that's how they've kept it out. It's an elimination strategy, and that's what they've done ever since. And it's still the case now. I mean, I'm going back to New Zealand later this year, and even though by that stage, hopefully I'll have two vaccinations, I'll still have to go into this government quarantine. So that's their plan for the time being. But what their plan is for the long term has a huge question mark overhanging, and I really hope the government does have a plan that's going
to
work.
Well, I mean, apparently it is to tell the world we're open. I mean, is this effectively the plan that we're going to open up the world? But what you've just said to me suggests we're going to open up the plan, but
see, that's
while closing it at the same time.
It's very confusing, isn't it? So what are they saying? We're open to your business, but not to your people. If Jacinda Ardern is going to go on this big promotional drive to let the world know that New Zealand is there and we're up and running and we don't have COVID. But what's the strategy there? Does she want people to come to New Zealand? Because I don't think Kiwis would allow an influx of all of these people from all around the world without having to quarantine or anything like that. So I would be really interested to know what Jacinda Ardern and her government is planning here for a long-term future, because elimination strategy is not something that you can keep there forever, is it? You can't. You're going to have to open your borders at some stage, unless you want to remain a hermit state forever, but I just don't see that as a long-term strategy.
It was a strategy that gathered a lot of praise, given the fact that the coronavirus infection levels were low. But do we have any idea about how much damage a full lockdown for such a long time actually did to other areas of society, such as the economy, such as society itself, and indeed how we now view New Zealand?
Well, you mean the New Zealand economy?
Yes.
Or, well, I mean, New Zealand was only in lockdown for about, I think it was 7 weeks or 8 weeks until it came back and they were like, okay, we don't have any COVID. And I mean, it's easy to do when you've got 5 million people, right? So when I talk to my friends back home and you hear them talk about, oh, it was such a tough year last year. And it's like, hang on a second, we're still in lockdown over in the United Kingdom. Most of the world is still in lockdown. And you guys are complaining and talking about how hard 8 weeks of lockdown was. And the government projections in terms of its finances were pretty dire. At that stage, they had to, lend out billions of dollars to keep businesses and people afloat in terms of their jobs and financial support and stuff like that. But they've since done a few mini budgets, and the big budget's coming in, I think, next week. And the books are actually looking a lot better than they, even the government thought, even Treasury thought. So New Zealand's domestic economy is actually looking pretty good. People out there have got money to spend. We've got a housing crisis. People can't spend money on holidays and stuff. So, they're buying up houses. So we've got a housing crisis. There's no building supplies left. But, if you go to a building supply shop, you can't sell it to people because there's, all the builders and the building companies are buying it all up. And there's a shortage of hot tubs. And so the domestic economy is going well, but I just don't know how sustainable that will be.
Frankly, I don't know how they're coping with a shortage of hot tubs. It's ghastly. One thing you mentioned, though, was the fact that when you go back to New Zealand, you're hoping to be double jabbed. This is an indication that the United Kingdom certainly has got its act together in terms of giving people the vaccine. And here in the UK, we've seen numbers absolutely plummet, and bar a resurgence of the Indian variant of coronavirus, the lockdown plan will be to open up within the next month. Things are going in the right direction. By comparison, New Zealand is not taking that us first approach, is it? It's a much slower idea. It's a much slower system.
Yes, Jacinda Ardern came out and gave a speech, and she said it would be selfish of us, given that we don't have COVID here, it would be selfish of us to demand from AstraZeneca or Pfizer or Moderna that they supply us with vaccines now, because our population doesn't have COVID, we don't have a health crisis, and there are other countries, pretty much most other countries around the world, who need it much more than us. And so that means the vaccine rollout that was planned has only essentially been rolled out to frontline workers, key workers, those who are working at airports, on the borders, at the ports and things like that. And it amounts to about 250,000 people, so 5% of the New Zealand population. And even within that, there's battles in rolling that out. So you compare that to what the UK's done, and how many vaccines are there now? 35 million or 38 million vaccines. And so you could, it's just really hard to compare. So that's the strategy in New Zealand. I really think if Ardern is going to do this whole we're open for business thing, she really needs to up the ante, vaccinate the New Zealand population. It's only 5 million people. And then you'll be able to start opening people up to those who have got vaccines.
If she says we're open for business, are people actually going to listen now? Do you think the world will listen, will respond to that call?
I think to somewhere like New Zealand that hasn't had COVID, I think they probably would respond. They can go, they'd go to New Zealand, jump on a plane and go there. And if they know it's a safe place and they've got their act together, then yeah, absolutely.
And in all that, they're going to be the ideas of travel bubbles and most importantly, perhaps, the travel between Australia and New Zealand, which is clearly an absolutely key thing that needs to be started again. What is going to happen with them? And are Australia and New Zealand actually going to find themselves able to move freely or between each other?
Yep, and the travel bubble launched last week or 2 weeks ago. So the travel bubble between New Zealand and Australia is in place, but there's like a traffic light system. So if there is some new variants, or I think there was a case in Perth, which they couldn't track and trace back. So New Zealand was like, right, we're pausing that travel. So travel between Perth and New Zealand was paused, but between the other states it was allowed, and you've seen tens of thousands of people fly between the two countries. But then, you know, there's also talk about opening up to the Pacific Islands. That is also comes with a whole lot of risk as well. So, I mean, the travel bubble thing is a good short-term plan, and it's probably a stepping stone, not a long-term plan.
Lloyd Burr, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come, a recap of the last 7 days' news, and we'll have a look at the papers too. But first, with the time just coming up to 7:28 here in London, a quick summary of the latest world news headlines. Fully vaccinated Americans have been told they can stop wearing face masks in most indoor and outdoor settings. The latest guidance comes as rates of vaccinations begin to slow in the US, with 1 in 3 people now fully vaccinated in the US. Experts say the change could herald a return to normalcy. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been cleared of wrongdoing in the WE charity scandal. The charity had been asked to oversee a volunteer program for students during the pandemic. Mr. Trudeau faced scrutiny when it was revealed he had personal ties to the organisation. And the centre of the city of Paris could be free of traffic by as early as next year. The city council wants to ban through traffic in 4 central districts, giving priority instead to cyclists, pedestrians and public transport. The mayor, Anne Hidalgo, was re-elected last year on a platform of creating the 15-minute city, where people need to travel no more than 15 minutes to access essential services. And those are the headlines on The Globalist. Now it's time for the final instalment of our vaccine hesitancy series. As we've seen throughout this week, COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy has taken hold in a wide range of communities. But how much of an impact does a lack of vaccine uptake actually have? Well, today we hear from Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith, to understand why the vaccine is the best hope of ending the pandemic and how even the smallest gaps in global uptake could undermine the response so far.
In order to control the coronavirus, apart from public health measures like lockdowns, which are a blunt instrument, very costly on many levels, our surefire way out of this is the same way we found our way out of previous scrapes in the past, and that is with vaccination. Because what this does is it prevents people from succumbing to severe disease, and in a very significant number of cases, it also stops them catching and passing on the infection. And that's been the headache with this coronavirus, because about half of people have few or such few symptoms that when they catch it that they don't know they've got it. So they therefore go around spreading it. So breaking that chain of transmission is very critical.
Silent spreaders could be responsible for about half of all coronavirus cases.
59%, that is the number of transmissions by people who don't even know that they're sick, and those people are unknowingly becoming the new source of outbreaks. Now, the study was done by the CDC.
The single biggest false assumption that we made was about the potential for asymptomatic transmission.
If we don't get people taking the vaccine at a sufficient level, then we leave threaded through society conduits through which infection can flow. And that means we'll maintain a chain of transmission, and then the pandemic won't go away. Our current estimates are, and these are purely based on guesstimates because we just don't know at the moment and we don't have the benefit yet of data. We think we have to achieve something in the region of 70, 75, maybe 80% vaccination rates in order to curtail the spread of the infection. That's based on what we've really done in the past with other vaccines and other disorders and diseases that spread in a similar way to the new coronavirus and are equivalently infectious to the new coronavirus. One thing to bear in mind, though, is that doesn't mean 75% of the population at one end of the age spectrum. That means about 75 to 80% of the population across the age spectrum. And therein lies the current wrinkle, because in the majority of countries, the vaccine effort has been focused in quite a polarised way, with good reason, towards those most at risk. And those most at risk are older people, which means there's actually a very significant population of younger people who are currently unvaccinated, down at the region of maybe 80, 90% of those. And those are the people, critically, who are more likely to have more friends, go out more, more often in work, on public transport, and therefore have more risk factors for transmitting the infection. Stamping out the virus means you've got to stop it where it spreads, and where it spreads most is going to have a whole range of factors behind it, which we need to look at. We're learning them, and they range from sort of social and demographic reasons through to age and pre-existing health conditions. But I think in the long run, it just means we've got to get to as many people as possible with vaccines as promptly as possible so that we can stamp the virus down before it comes back with a variant that can bypass the protection conferred by these vaccines. The world is a giant community, and when we say pandemic, the word pandemic comes from Greek pan, all, demos, people. It's basically afflicting everybody everywhere, which is why we all agree it's not over everywhere till there's no COVID anywhere. And the only way we can achieve that is by stamping it out everywhere. And there are therefore important considerations behind not having a I'm all right, Jack mentality, because if we ignore countries with lots of people in them, lots of deprivation, and therefore lots of COVID, we're potentially brewing up the variant that will come back to bite us.
Bleak day dawned in Delhi. The official number of deaths reached a new high at the same time that it was acknowledged tests are failing to identify large numbers.
As India's streets empty because of localized lockdowns, burial grounds and crematoriums continue to work day and night.
These raging fires will continue all day and through the evening. The surge in cases has been so much that there's a waiting really for these bodies to be put on the pyre by family members.
When the pandemic first began to grow and we realised that we were in this for the long haul and we realised that we needed vaccines to rescue us, and this was in the first half of last year, 2020, at that time, people were very sceptical indeed in many first world countries. And in fact, a number of eminent researchers conducted studies that suggested that, for instance, if you pulled a person off the street in America and said to them, I've got a vaccine against coronavirus, would you like it? In some cases, half of people were saying, no thanks. That has changed. And the number of people who are now vaccine hesitant in America has fallen considerably. The number in the UK has fallen considerably. It was never as high as the vaccine hesitant rates in America, but it was high in certainly some communities. But what we predicted would happen, and I think you know, this is speculation on my part, but I think has been manifest, is that people who were initially sceptical, because it's quite right that people should want to know what they're putting into their body and what it does to them, and should want to be reassured by good solid data of proving safety. But I think those more sceptical people have probably seen the fact that millions of people in older age groups have now had these vaccines, that the vaccines are performing well, they're performing safely, and as a result, people are not losing lives. We estimate that tens of thousands of lives have already been saved by vaccination.
These vaccines are safe, they've saved many thousands of lives, and people should come forward to get their jabs, and we'll make sure that they get the right jabs.
And that is giving confidence to people who previously might have been more sceptical and more hesitant. In order to get the confidence of the public, it's really important that politicians put their money where their mouth is and they act accordingly. You cannot have a situation where you're saying, you do this, and it's a case of do what I say, not what I do. You have to lead from the front.
Initially, back in January, President Emmanuel Macron questioned the vaccine's effectiveness for people over 65. Then, the country, along with several others, acted on its own, suspending AstraZeneca without final recommendations from the European regulator.
There were certain politicians in the previous few months who have not been helpful, I think, in the vaccine initiative, because people won't see these vaccines necessarily as individual entities. They will see the vaccine against coronavirus as an entity. And therefore, if one lets the side down, it damages the brand for everybody. And this was always a criticism that if we end up with one of these vaccines that doesn't work, or it produces serious side effects or harms people or is found to have a problem, this would considerably bolster vaccine hesitancy. We need to make sure that everyone's on board, because if we don't solve this problem everywhere, it's never going to go away, because it will keep on coming back. It will seed itself back into populations frequently because people are mobile, people travel, diseases go with them. And this will not stay confined to one place. It started in one corner of one city in one country and very quickly has taken over the lives of every single one of us in every corner of the world, pretty much. That will keep repeating itself, that recipe, if you end up with this virus taking up residence in poor places with poor public health measures, poor surveillance, and poor abilities to intervene. So for that reason, we have to make sure that those communities, and those communities where that sort of thing can happen anywhere on Earth. And therefore, we have to make sure that everyone's on board. And the best way to do that is with clear communication and clear information, so everyone understands where they stand, where the planet as a whole, you know, the human population stands, and what we can do to get ourselves out of this.
And my thanks to Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith, there. If you missed any of this week's series on vaccine hesitancy, listen into this Sunday's special episode of The Curator to hear the full series. You're listening to Monocle 24. And it's time to continue today's Globalist by looking at the newspapers. Joining me down the line is Stephanie Boltson, who's the UK and Ireland correspondent for Die Welt. A very good morning to you, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Right, let's begin with a story which I suspect, as the United Kingdom moves its way out of lockdown and into a more free society, is something that will rather worry us, given the fact that there's this spread of the new Indian variant within the UK.
Yeah, exactly. That's a story that is covered by many papers in the UK today. As we know, on Monday is Monday, May 17, is the day of the big opening. Especially the pubs are allowed to serve drinks and food indoors again. Theatres and cinemas and other places in limited capacity are allowed to open. But at the same time, there has been a growing spread of the so-called Indian variant in the UK. And while Boris Johnson just said that he's cautiously optimistic, his roadmap out of lockdown would continue, and that actually that this Indian variant called B16172 did not take off in the way some people feared, you still see some pockets in the UK, and especially in England. So in places like Blackburn or Bolton, and especially among young people. So the infections among young people are 10 times higher than the national average. And now, of course, the question is, what do you do with that? And how do you counter these measures? And there are talks now to search vaccines in these areas. So also have people that are actually not yet on the prior or not at the invited to have the jabs, to have them already. The problem with that, as far as I understand, is that this will pretty much put the organization by the NHS of the vaccine rollout into turmoil. And as we speak, I guess there are a lot of discussions going on in Downing Street about that.
Indeed. I mean, the regional approach, I think some have suggested that the national age needs to be lowered, more people need to be vaccinated in what's known as surge vaccinations, as you've mentioned. But suddenly you find that the politicians start to wade in as well. The mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, is challenging Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, for refusing to rule out a return to local lockdowns. He's wanting different approaches to vaccinations. It gives you the impression that suddenly this smooth path out of lockdown is going to be bumpier than many feared, than many hoped, I should say.
Yeah, and I guess that has always been the fear. And there's also a lot of political capital being put out there. If you think of Andy Burnham, the Labour Metro Mayor of Manchester, we remember his massive fight with Boris Johnson last year ago when the Prime Minister decided to lock down Manchester. So there are many things at the same time. But of course, Monday is something that pubs and entertainment venues have been preparing for months, and they have put a lot of money into this, and this in a time when they're struggling economically anyway. So it would be very, very difficult to now talk again about any kind of national lockdown. So it does, in a way, make sense to look at the situation and try to limit and control the spread in those areas where you find it. And actually, I think last night there were reports from, I think it was Bolton, that they are, which they have done also in the past with the South African mutation, they are going from house to house and asking people to do PCR tests to make sure that even if they don't have symptoms, if they are positive and if they have that Indian mutation, that they isolate.
Let's move on to a story which has been reported not only here in the United Kingdom in The Guardian, but also in Italy in La Repubblica. It is a frankly jaw-dropping story, a horrifying story about EU citizens who are coming over to the United Kingdom either to do internships or for job interviews, are finding themselves in immigration removal centres and detention rooms.
Yeah, exactly. And we are running the story as well yesterday because I managed to talk to a 25-year-old Spanish woman who was detained in Gatwick on the 3rd of May. So she's a graduate from Valencia. And she, I mean, to be fair, of course, As an EU citizen, you have to know what are your rights and what are your obligations if you travel now to the United Kingdom, because the United Kingdom is not an EU member anymore. And that means if you have not had something called settled status or pre-settled status before the or you had applied for it before the 31st of December, now you need to have a visa unless you are coming for tourism, which currently is not very likely. But that young woman arrived in Gatwick. She was asked what was her purpose of the travel. And she said, I'm going to visit my sister and then I want to look for a job. Do you have a visa? No, I don't. So then it was pretty traumatic what they did to her. They put her in a room. She didn't know what was going on. She managed briefly to call her sister and say, look, I'm stuck here. Then they took her mobile away. She spent the night at the Gatwick airport and then was transferred to a detention removal center. Oh, it's called an immigration removal center. It's called Yarl's Wood. It's like 100 kilometers north of London, where she spent the next 5 days in something that is pretty much a prison. On top of that, they had a case of COVID, and she then was allowed to leave and stay with her sister in quarantine there. But the whole experience has been very traumatic. She will have to return to Spain now, and she said to me she wouldn't think to, or I'm not sure she would ever return to the UK because this has been so traumatic, and she's afraid that could happen to her again.
Arguably, this is diplomatically disastrous insofar as, you know, in order to make Brexit a success, you can't start locking up Spanish women going to visit their sisters. But you also have this more long-term issue as to how Brexit sort of manages itself, and how you do deal with people who are coming for a job interview when arguably the whole system has had to change.
Yeah, and I think while diplomatically this doesn't look good, I do think from my experience with the Home Office and the British Home Office and covering the British Home Office, actually these headlines are what they want, because they want people to read this and they want people to realize that they can't come to the UK anymore if they don't already have a status or the right to stay. They are pretty cynical about that, and we remember the Windrush scandal. We remember the key word of the hostile environment, of scaring immigrants to go back to their country or not coming to the UK at all. And therefore, I think, I looked through au pair sites yesterday, and there is very little information out there. People or young people all over Europe will think, oh yeah, great idea, I go to the UK and take a job now. They can't. And this is also the fault, I think, of the member states. They have to do a broader information campaign that now you cannot go so easily to the UK anymore.
Stephanie Boltson, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Just nudging 7:47 here in London. It's time to take a look now at what's making the news in the Balkans with our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaney joining us on the line from Ljubljana. Good morning. Welcome back to The Globalist, Guy. Good to have you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me, Emma.
It's a pleasure. Right, let's crack on with the idea of what the European Union is doing when it comes to discussing the Western Balkans. EU foreign ministers met this week to talk about it. It's all to do with the accession process, which the EU quite likes to turn into a sort of like long, seductive dance.
Yeah, it's not so much of, well, long seductive dance. My goodness, that would be, sounds rather nice, doesn't it? But it's just a grind and not in a good way, I'm afraid. not for any of these countries. I mean, if you're looking at, say, for example, Serbia, they officially opened accession talks, I think it was about 8 years ago now. And they've been given this target date to get into the European Union of 2025. I don't think there's anybody in this region who genuinely believes that's going to happen. And it just gets ridiculous. And people look at this promised land of the European Union and they say, whatever they ask us to do, we're never going to be able to do it. As soon as we do one thing, they'll ask us to do another. And a prime example of this at the moment would be North Macedonia. Now, you may remember the North Macedonia not so long ago was called Macedonia, and it changed its name to please its neighbour Greece. I won't go into the details, but now it's finding it's got a problem with Bulgaria, saying that, no, we can't open accession talks with you until you acknowledge your Bulgarian heritage. And this is the only thing stopping North Macedonia from starting talks now. And all of this sort of shenanigans, Emma, is leading the European Union belatedly to wake up. And they've issued an internal report saying that we're losing the region, basically, that because of all these shenanigans, we risk losing influence to people like China and Russia.
How much of a realistic prospect is it that the Balkans will lose faith in the European Union? I mean, patience is a virtue, but you can understand why they're getting very fed up with all this. But ultimately, the prize is EU membership.
That's right. But, you know, you can see from the way Turkey's gone in recent years that, you know, if you keep people hanging on for too long, they do give up and go in another direction. And for these countries, they've seen two of their former ex-Yugoslavia neighbours, which is Slovenia and Croatia, join the European Union. So they know that it's not impossible. And all of them are saying this process is a way for us, these chapters that we've got to clear, it's a way for us to make reforms, to turn ourselves into modern, prosperous countries. And we acknowledge that we've got to do that. But I think the European Union's public relations have been quite appalling all the way along. They never really explain what the process is, what the benefits are, and they never really make out that they really would be quite delighted to have the countries of the Western Balkans join them. It always seems to be, you're far too naughty or disorganized to join us. We couldn't possibly have you until you scrub yourselves up again and again and again. Never, we think you're great, we'd like you on board. Can we work together to make it happen? Those are the sort of noises I'd like to be hearing if I were a citizen of those countries. And instead, they're hearing, "Your very naughty children, behave better."
Let's move to Zagreb, where there seems to be quite a serious issue to do with a cable car, of all things.
Would you believe it? And I'm bringing this up because we've mentioned it on Monocle 24 before. We like things like cable cars, don't we? And this one in Zagreb, on the edge of Zagreb, on the Sljeme mountain, has been closed for a long time, for many years, and it's been renovated. It's going to reopen. It'll be integrated into the city transport system. And yet, just when we're approaching the finishing line, all sorts of shenanigans, because local residents are complaining it's too noisy. One woman who complained that it was too noisy, then the very next day, somebody, persons unknown, burnt her car in front of her house. So it's got quite nasty, really. And meanwhile, there are all these allegations flying around that the electricity substation isn't adequate for powering the cable car and the adjoining tramway, which takes you into the city. The city authorities are firing back, saying, no, everything's okay. But it does seem that, again, installing your transport infrastructure is not necessarily a simple matter.
And being briefly, I mean, how does this thing get resolved? I mean, obviously, this woman's now lost her car, but this obviously is pointing to a longer term issue.
Yes, it is. And it may get resolved by the elections that we've got in the municipalities of Croatia over the weekend, including in Zagreb, where for the first time in 20 years, we'll have a new mayor because the previous incumbent, Milan Bandic, died a couple of months ago. And there could be big changes there with the Green Left candidate looking like he's going to win.
Guy Delaunay, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally, let's hear from Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller, for his wrap of the week's news cycle.
We learned this week that the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom owes someone money. Not, and you may want to brace yourself for the impact of this devastating satirical salvo, the citizens of London, who still want a word about 53 million quid which got spaffed on an unbuilt garden bridge during his stint as mayor, but a creditor, unknown as of this recording, whom Boris Johnson appears to have stiffed for £535. Actually, could it be someone who has contracted to build a 100,000th of the garden bridge? Like maybe lay a brick or plant a petunia? If this isn't a cue for the general muttered agreement clip, whatever would be. We learned of the Prime Minister's impecunity because Private Eye magazine thought to search county court records and found a judgment against Johnson for that amount. So we've learned that should Johnson be unable to raise this sum soonish, the gaiety of the nation may be enlarged in coming weeks by hired goons kicking in the UK's most famous door and seizing the Downing Street trouser press. If £535 roughly is what trouser presses cost? Not that, judging by his usual deportment, Boris Johnson is familiar with such an appliance. Killing it this week, we are. Actually, we learned, having just looked it up, that a standard Corby trouser press runs to about 170 quid. So if the bailiffs take three trouser presses and maybe a couple of Downing Street coffee mugs, that should get in there. Happy as ever to help. Anyway. Sticking with the subject of national leaders with somewhat opaque personal finances, we learned that Russian President Vladimir Putin's legendary prowess on the hockey rink has not waned during lockdown. President President Putin returned to the ice in Sochi in an all-star game and scored no fewer than 9 of his victorious team's 13 goals. We learned from the somewhat willfully lackadaisical demeanour of the other team that in hockey, as in most other fields of endeavour, it perhaps does not pay to oppose Putin too forcefully. And we learned that keenness in support for Putin's endeavours seems to be solid career sense, judging by the performance of the extremely enthusiastic commentator and, who knows, next mayor of Moscow. Here is that giddy encomium to the great helmsman's skills, as translated by Monocle 24's personality cult desk chief, Paige Reynolds.
To the centre, oh, a class pass there. Oh, and it's 3 for Vladimir Putin, still a legend. Even though there are some really strong players on either side, Vladimir Putin took the initiative.
In the United States, we learned that protection from the ravages of a potentially fatal disease is insufficient enticement to pitch up to receive a free vaccine, as far as the citizens of at least one state are concerned. Maestro, the official rock song of Ohio. We learned, because by golly we do our research, that the McCoys' lone hit, Hang On Sloopy, was formally enshrined as Ohio's official rock song by Ohio's State Congress in 1985. We also learned that at least one of the clauses of the exquisitely drafted pertinent resolution deserves a reading by Monocle 24's whimsical legislation desk chief, Carlotta Ribello.
Whereas adoption of this resolution will not take too long, cost the state anything, or affect the quality of life in this state to any appreciable degree, and if we in the legislature just go ahead and pass the darn thing, we can get on with more important stuff.
We may be deviating somewhat from the point, which is that we learned that Ohio is seeking to overcome widespread reluctance vis-a-vis vaccines by offering 5 randomly selected jabbies $1 million each, which, for UK listeners, is enough to clear Boris Johnson's debts 1,331 times over. And we learned of similar incentives elsewhere in the US. $100 for vaccinated state employees in Maryland, savings bonds for kids in West Virginia, a free fishing license in Maine, and in New Jersey, determined as always to pull the most New Jersey move available in any given situation, a free beer. New Jersey. New Florida, more like. And we learned of another sort of vaccine incentive invented by accident here in the UK, just like penicillin was. In the seaside settlement of Plymouth, there was confusion at Home Park, imaginatively named home ground, of obstinately mediocre local sports team Plymouth Argyle FC. A queue for vaccines being dispensed at the stadium became enmeshed with a likely shorter queue for Plymouth Argyle season tickets. So we learned that those Plymouth supporters who misread the signs explaining which line was which have received a gift arguably worth even more than $1 million. Not only are they now inoculated against COVID-19, they won't have to watch Plymouth Argyle next season. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
My thanks to Andrew and all the team for pulling that together. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Paige Reynolds, Carlotta Ribello, Alexis Self and Charlie Phil McCourt, and our studio manager, Maylee Evans, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu and Louis Allen. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London, and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.